SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Wednesday. Race fans, Sirius 219 XM 201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website too, stevebick.com. Yeah, I've lost track of days. You always, whenever you have that travel day, a little bit out of whack. Take a couple of days to get into the swing. Of course, staying up to watch the Westminster show last night. It's like Lucy in the football every year. I mean, first of all, the dog that I like, Vizsla's, they never seem to make it out of their group, and so then you latch on to one of them. One of the group winners, and you think you've got a win, and then they pick a poodle. I'm not disparaging poodle owners. Good grief. Hey, come on. The toy poodle, the full-size poodle, the intermediate poodle, the poodle. Everybody in the building. Then there's that poor boxer. That boxer, she's the Susan Lucci of Westminster. She's a finalist every year. What is she, 17? Every year she's in the judging. She wins her group every year. She wins sporting, and they send her home empty-handed. Well, listen, you win a group. I guess that's a big deal too. I find it entertaining. And I don't know, the Fox. Raise your hand if you preferred it, the coverage when it was on USA. The Fox coverage, I don't know. But I have to watch it. I have to watch it. I'm just compelled. It's competition and it's entertaining and you have a rooting interest. And I'm sure there's betting action on. There must be, right? I don't know. The whole thing seems. I don't know. I'm sure it's very political. It's more. It feels more and more, especially with this Fox coverage. I don't know. It feels a lot like Best in Show, the great satire, parody of the show. So I don't know. I'm sure there'll be lots of angry response from poodle owners. I love discovering some of these new dogs. You saw that thing the other day. I when I was coming back Monday, I discovered that new dog. There was a preliminary thing going on, and I was having lunch at Midway, and they showed this West African sighthound who looked pretty cool. But then last night there was this hairless thing. What was that? The American hairless terrier? Come on. American hairless terrier. American hairless. I'm sorry. You're gonna spend a bunch of money on a purebred dog, and you went and got an American hairless terrier. It's like one of those Sphinx cats you just cringe every time you look at it. But I don't know. I'm compelled every time to watch this, and I. I guess we go through this every year where I'm not complaining about it. You know the movie, have you seen Go? I assume everybody has seen Go, which is wonderful. And there's that great scene where Timothy Oliphant is talking about the comics and how much he hates Family Circle. But yet he's compelled to read it. You know, there it is, you know, waiting to ruin your comic reading experience. It's the same thing. It's like you look forward to it, and every year you come away, you know, it's 11 o'clock at night, and you're like, I waited up for this. I waited up for this. And you know, my favorite part about the poodle discussions is, oh, don't judge them by the poofy haircut. They're so athletic. You have no idea what they used to do in the 1500s. Come on with this. Look what you've done to them. Unbelievable. All right, that's my Westminster treatment for this year. Maybe we'll just, you know, cut out the 5 minutes and play it every year. I don't know. I just get me a Vizsla into, you know, into the final seven, and I'll be happy. It's a dog that was imperiled during World War II, targeted by the Nazis for extermination. It's the royal dog of Hungary, and essentially felt to be the smartest canine breed. And I mean, they're gorgeous. They're just absolutely gorgeous, and yet they never get any attention. You know, it's. They're like, there were down, there were less than, there were somewhere between 3 and 4 dozen left after World War II. And then the breed was built back up. And I'm sure that every Vizsla owner in America can, they all probably all trace back to, you know, a handful of progenitors. I had the chance to get one. My friend, Dr. Cheros, John Cheros, North Shore Animal League, and forget the name of his vet clinic there, Valley Stream, and John had one, they had one at the at his clinic, and I think I was still living in Montreal, and I couldn't adopt it. I lived in an apartment, like a condo-y townhouse, and I've always regretted that I couldn't figure out a way to adopt that dog. It was like 3 years old, and somehow I don't know what the deal was that John, they ended up with it, and I regret. And then Tina and I discussed that she would like a dog. We have the cats. You know, we got a ton of cats, 4 of them. And she says that as they, you know, as they go on to cat heaven, they won't be replaced. So she's waiting for a dog, and I can't convince her either. She wants a dog, you know, that'll fit in the overhead compartment on a plane. So, or under the seat in front of you. Hey now, tip your waitresses. I'm sorry, tip your servers. All right, can we start the show? I don't know where to go from here. I want to talk to Pete, and I'm anxious. There's been so much fun discussion, and boy, it's so great to have, you know, healthy dialogue on the internet, so widely available, and you know, and everyone's so polite and treat each other with such grace and respect. The there's a terrific Tony Joe wrote a terrific kind of guest piece for the website for Pete with and Jonathan, the In the Money show, and he talks about the approach that needs to be used to win an HC, and it's really interesting. He essentially is saying that, you know, the cap type horses, the, you know, essentially 19 to 1 shots, that's your avenue. And after reading it, I went through, and I'm anxious to see what Pete thinks. But on Friday and Saturday, there were four cap horses on Friday, four, you know, of the kinds of horses that Tony wrote about, and they paid. I basically used anything that was over 15 to 1 because, you know, there's, you know, horses may have been floating and, you know, they may have been 20 to 1 as they headed to post and then come down a little bit. So anything that paid over a combined tote of $40 towards your total. And there were four of those, four and a half, because there was a place horse in the Gulfstream ninth that was a cap place horse. But in terms of winners, there were four. The Gulfstream fourth, Fairgrounds third, Oaklawn seventh, and Golden Gate fourth. 46, 43, 57, 80, and 64. Cap horse, that Golden Gate there in the fourth. Golden Gate really did prove out to be the, in a lot of ways, the key to, you know, there was the cap horse on Saturday as well, and, you know, et cetera. So four on Friday, and then on Saturday, there were seven, and two were mandatory horses, as it happens. And then another five around the rest of the day, including Tampa, where you had, actually, I take that back. There were three cap horses, three big price horses in the mandatories on Saturday, because there was the Gulfstream fifth that was actually that Golden Tappet, and Mike Welch had they had a big workout. That was the Brendan Walsh, the horse that had been transferred to Walsh from last year as a 2-year-old that Christoph had. But Golden Tappet, 33.40 and 13.60. And Admiralty Pier at Tampa, 58. But there were three others at Tampa, too. 41.40, 63.80, 51.20. Anyway, the point is that Tony Joe, you know, he's got, you know, the financial mindset. He ran a series of, he's got 20,000 or 50,000. He's got a huge base of races, and he ran simulations, basically saying that going after these kinds of horses is the way to go. That's the formula to win. He looked at the strike rate, how many times, if you tried it, you know, at different price points. I think he used 4 to 1, 9 to 1, and 19 to 1. And how many times you would get to the semifinals, you would get into the top 10% utilizing those different avenues. I mean, and I, there's so much more to it, but there's a lot of lessons in here about your day-to-day play as well. One thing I didn't do as I totaled up those horses over the 2 days, I am curious to see how many of these were grass races. I mean, obviously the two Oaklawn races aren't. Fairgrounds Friday wasn't because they were off the turf. So, but Tampa, yeah, I think the Tampas might have won two. Yeah, three of the four Tampas on Saturday were on the turf. You know, you would expect that the turf is going to produce, you know, more big prices. But you're never guaranteed. I mean, what's the average number of these kinds of prices to come in? So that discussion, and there's been a lot more follow-up, actually in part because of what Tony wrote about. Discussion of which came up with us on the conversation, you know, as we went to different arenas about cutting back the mandatories, making it, you know, way more optional oriented, you know, or maybe mandatories on Friday to get it to Saturday. The idea of having more cut lines. There's a lot of that, and then some very interesting discussion actually about, you know, the influence of the players, those that are, you know, on the tour, and, you know, that are making the magic happen, and. They're having input, the prize structure, and a lot. It's good. And this seems to happen every year. And there's, you know, a certain percentage of rancor and people complaining about the cost structure. And I the same answer every year. They're doing their best, and, you know, if it's prohibitive, you know, it's like when you pick out a car. If it's too expensive, to you, do something else. Let's take a quick break. Lots to do. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $125 are on them. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code BYK. That's B-Y-K. And you'll get $125 when you wager $500 within your first 30 days. See what I mean? House money just for playing the races you were going to bet anyway. Check out ExpressBet.com for more information. And don't forget to sign up using promo code BYK. B-Y-K to get that $125 bonus. You're going to love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee.
Conditions apply. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states. Open account with ExpressBet LLC and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void, or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line, 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
The North American foal crop continues to decline, but not here in Pennsylvania. In 2019, our number of mares bred increased for the third year in a row, this time by 12.5%. Why? Our stallion roster continues to grow. We have the best incentives and bonuses. Plus, there's the stability of our racehorse development fund. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Took a trip on a bus that I didn't know. Met a girl selling drinks at the disco. Said truth comes back when you let it go. Seems
because it's really so simple. Walking down Young Street on a Friday, can't follow them, gotta do it my way. No fast lane, still on the highway, moving in and out, no doubt there's a ride.
No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. Take off the grass in the bucket. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. No time to get down, cause I'm moving up. Take off the grass in the bucket.
We're back. 20 minutes into the Wednesday get-together. Sid Fernando, top of hour two. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. We'll talk to both Jeremy and Seth Merrill later. And what else? I've got, as I dig through piles here, a couple of things from the weekend that we didn't as we dig through. I want to mention, did we talk about the King Cotton? And I reached out to John Secura after on Sunday. That was a big performance. This is a really nice 5-year-old gelding. And I think I mentioned on the broadcast over the weekend, this is a horse that some friends of Secura, some hockey buddies, they wanted to have some fun. They wanted to have a racehorse, and they've really got themselves into a nice position. The McLean's Music gelding that John bred and his brother Glenn. This is an Ontario Hillendale bred, and career best performance, 104 buyer, winning the King Cotton. So I'm sure he'll stay on the Oaklawn sprint, toward the Count Fleet and et cetera, and or the what's the sprint on the during the racing festival? Is that the Count Fleet? I think so. I think we've got Pete. We do. We've got Pete. Pete, we were looking all over Brooklyn. Where were you?
A little bit of a slow start to the morning here. I am still, I'm not back in proper East Coast time yet, so I've been scrambling a bit. But thank you for bearing with me, and always a pleasure as we recover and get back to it to be on with you.
Well, I prefaced the visit talking about the really entertaining piece that Tony Joe wrote for the website and some of the themes that it introduced, and we'll get to that as soon as we give you the opportunity to kind of collect your thoughts from Sunday afternoon and evening, and had 72 hours essentially to absorb everything. Some further conclusions to what we enjoyed over the weekend.
It was an amazing NHC, really fantastic, getting a chance to catch up with so many old friends and make so many new ones, and following all that action, many leaderboard changes and great stories. And I guess the thing that surprised me the most since we got back is just the continued interest in it. There's just been so much talk, whether it's people commenting on the broadcasting or folks wanting to talk about whichever their idea is in terms of tweaking the rules or strategy. It just feels like more than usual, even, the event has promoted a lot of interest among horse players, and I think that's great. It's been fun keeping that conversation going, and I think you mentioned the Tony Joe piece, which was a fantastic, one of the smartest guys out there. I'm going to be writing not really a recap so much as my own reflections of the things that I like the best about the event and things that maybe could be done a little bit better. I'll be doing that, and that should be getting published in the next day or two. But it just the amount of interest that people have in this thing, it's very, very cool, and I'm happy to keep the momentum going and keep the conversation going about how a great event can get even better.
Well, and that conversation is always healthy, and there's some offshoots of it about how player desires and reflections and interests and suggestions can get distilled into the process. That I thought was that came out yesterday. I thought it was, for the most part, very healthy. There seems to be a certain class of conversationalist that can't discuss anything without just throwing a brick. Every single response has to be a brick bat. I've never seen anything like it. These must be the people that jump out of cars with baseball bats and smash people's windshields, I guess, with road rage, because it doesn't seem like it's a dialogue that anybody in real life would possibly survive for more than 3 minutes or at a job. They're certainly not in customer service.
It is interesting and different, some of the communication. I will say this, even some of the people who are at times relentless in their criticism of the event, I think that some of the ideas being put forth, if put through the filter of trying to be a little bit more constructive, there's some ideas that are worth exploring. And, you know, contrary to what I think some folks think out there, over the years, the NTRA and the Players Committee, they've done a great job listening to feedback, no matter how it was phrased, and have improved the event in lots of ways as a result of it. And the other thing that I'm very happy about with the NTRA themselves is it just feels to me like now, as opposed to when I started working with them when I was with DRF years ago, they seem much more interested in transparency about these things. And coming in, Keith Chandling comes on with us and talks about how the different seats are valued. And that's going to be that's just such a good thing for players, because it's just transparency is great, because you get the information out there and you let players decide what they want to do. And honestly, these were some of the things I wanted to write when I started years ago. And I was at that time by my employer discouraged from doing so. And I like the fact that the worm has turned in that regard. And it seems like the current regime very open to transparency, and I think that only good can come from it when you're very honest about the way these things work.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the elements of strategy, because that seems to be the one consistent element to the discussions that have come out of it, and even during the course of the contest, it became apparent on Sunday or Saturday when we were playing down to the top 10%, and even some of the most respected players and bettors of any ilk that made it into the top 10% were kind of laughing at their fortune, at their good fortune, because they said, well, I might as well just take some cap horses here with the last couple of shots, and lo and behold, the cap horses got you in. And that's part of what motivated Tony Joe's analysis. I mean, he got home, and it seems like he must have gotten home Sunday night and worked 24 straight hours coming up with that model.
He's amazing. Well, he's got a lot of. Tony is the king of man plus machine. He does a lot. He's not that he's not very hardworking, but he's very much about working smarter, I'd say, than working harder. So he'll get an idea and he has the computing power to run whatever crazy thing he did, the 50,000 Monte Carlo simulations between now and then. And it was very interesting because he was looking at the and I encourage everybody who wants to read it to check it out. It's over at the top thing right now at InTheMoneyPodcast.com, and it's definitely worth a read. He was talking about the optimal strategy from the jump at the NHC. And then this year, that was really brought into relief by the circumstances of having, especially those last two mandatory races, of having cap horses and having them be so late in the day. And this was something we talked about on air for the first time with Duke and Paul Matisse at the previous year's event. It didn't come into play, but Paul and Duke, being as sharp as they are, had seen how they had just envisioned how this could happen, where if you have your mandatory races late in the day, how it just takes handicapping and it throws it out the window in a way, because so many players at that point, if they're going to make the cut, they got to play the max races. No handicapping necessary. And there's really two ways that this can be improved, and I would assume the NTRA will do one or the other. One way would be to have a lot more racing left after your final mandatory race. Maybe the final mandatory race is midway through that semifinal round, or excuse me, midway through day two before we get to the semifinals, forcing people to really have to make decisions as to what type of horses they want to play. The other idea somebody floated to me in this flurry of conversation we've been having over the last couple of days is, and you know, I don't hate it, is have your mandatory races, but make them pick and pray. Essentially, in the mandatory races, at least on the second day, you have to put those picks in early. And all these rule tweaks, cut lines, and those type of suggestions, they're all geared towards one thing. And that thing is trying to make people, as much as possible, play the horses they like, as opposed to horses that they just need. You know, you're $65, $63 left, and there's one horse left, and there's only one cap horse in it. You know, your decision is made for you. Trying to get away from that as much as possible and towards the idea of people actually picking horses. They've made a lot of great moves towards that direction to keep it from just being bomb, bomb, bomb. But there's a few more moves that can be made. And what was so great about Tony's piece was suggesting that regardless, you're better off by the math in sticking to the high end of the odd spectrum. It was a very, very interesting piece.
And what I did immediately after reading it was to rifle through Friday and Saturday and see how many essentially there were. And I used anything over 15 to 1 because, of course, you know, as you're waiting and watching and making final selection, you might have a 19 to 1. And by the time the gates open, they're 15 to 1. So I figured anything over $40 essentially kind of fit the loose definition. And on Friday, there were four horses that fit this definition. Gulfstream fourth for $46.60, Fairgrounds third, $43.20, Oaklawn seventh, $57.80, and the Golden Gate cap horse, $64 in the fourth. There was also a cap place horse at Gulfstream. And then on Saturday, that's when it even ratcheted up further, just by virtue of, you know, we had the cancellation at Laurel. We never got any races in at Aqueduct on Friday. So on Saturday, you had the full opportunities and you had a total of seven $40 plus, including three of the, what was crazy is that three of the eight mandatories included these horses. So I guess the question is, Pete, there's no guarantee. And I guess that's what the simulation says when he says, you know, when he's running a model of 50,000 races to get, you know, the percentage of the three levels of play. But honestly, wouldn't the typical player, and even let's say a typical successful, you know, we talked on over the weekend about a lot of the players who are regularly, you know, making the top 10%, and even repeaters at the final table. I mean, Ray Arsenault might be a terrific, you know, show pony for this, because we know that Ray goes after these kinds of horses. But isn't the expectation more that players will weave a variety of these horses in? Meaning, if you see a 15, 18, 20 to 1 shot that has a look, but also be very satisfied to take some 9 to 1s. Isn't there a combination, you know, a column A, column B, column C, that is a more likely path to success?
That's certainly the way that my brain works, and I think the way a lot of players' brains work is to, quote-unquote, take what they give you. I did think it was very interesting, though, on the raw math, and, you know, when you look at things by the raw math, and they don't always work for every horse player, but on the raw math, Tony made a compelling case that you're better off eschewing anything that isn't in that 15-to-1 plus range you're talking about. Now, that would never work for me as a human being, simply because even though the math might tell me that that's the right thing to do, as a horse player, we talked about it over the weekend, the idea of gambling personalities, the idea of handicapping personalities, betting personalities. For me, those horses, it's not that I never find a cap horse, but I find them very, very rarely, honestly. So even though the math says that I'm wrong when I say I'd rather try to find 2 10-to-1s than 1 20-to-1, for me as a player, I couldn't get away from that latter view, even if the math tells me it's wrong. But it helps me as a player, even with my bent, it helps me as a player knowing what the math says, because it does make it that much easier to say, you know what, I really like this 6-to-1, but there's also a cap horse that like I can see. And it helps me in that situation to make the decision, well, I know I have to just go with the cap horse and live with it because the 6-to-1 isn't close enough. But I just know me, and the way I'd approach it, which would be more like the path that Scott Coles took. And we'll eventually get to see all of the Thomas Goldsmith plays and see that they've actually been – I was handed a piece of paper with them, but I haven't even looked at it yet, honestly. But you go back and you look at Scott Coles, and I don't think he had one full – cap horse. So there's you certainly don't need to do it the way that the math tells you is best, but it's super interesting and helpful to have that information. It just informs your decisions, even if you're not going to follow it by the letter.
Well, and I just got a great question sent to me too, asking about what is a cap horse for those that aren't close to the contest world, and explain the pricing, the 40 and 20 levels, and that is also, frankly, Pete, that is also part of this equation, because we've discussed this in the past, not recently, but you know, a horse that's 36-to-1, and taking that horse. As opposed to, you know, trying to at least emotionally justify to yourself that, you know, that this 18, 19, 21-to-1 horse has a real chance to win here, as opposed to just a horse that just seems completely impossible. I mean, I think the highest mutual we had over the weekend was the $85 cap horse.
So here's how caps work, and then we can talk a little bit about the why of them as well. But the idea in a mythical money contest, which is the only place these exist, is to limit the potential return any one horse can get you. It's to make it so the value isn't too outsized when that $85 horse comes in. So in contests, and it's typically agreed upon, you'll see a lower cap in some places, but typically 20-to-1 on the win. So the horse could be 21-to-1, you get 20-to-1. The horse could be 20-to-1, you still obviously get 20-to-1. The horse could be 40-to-1, you still only get that 20-to-1 on the win end, $42 the max. And on place, there's a cap as well at 10-to-1. So the most any horse can pay to place is 22. That makes the most you can receive from any one horse 64. And I think it's effective. It's definitely effective in reducing the amount of quote-unquote stabbing people just picking numbers on the board. It's pretty much universal. There's very few people, I think, who would argue against the idea of a cap horse in a contest like the NHC.
Yeah, I'm glad. I just wanted for those that, you know, those that are trying to make sense of, you know, of some of the, you know, some of the terminology and, you know, the ins and outs. The other portion of this that is getting and continues to have either traction or potential for traction is some wrinkles, some ways to satisfy, you know, certain style players, the whole $2 win place element, because there's so many Pete that that say, I'm happy to be here, I'm enjoying it, and this is fun, but I spent time with Andy Berg, Gumster Stable. Andy's a big player. A very big player, and he's qualified, I think, at least twice in the last 3 or 4 years, and he comes and he's because he loves Vegas and that he has a great time, but he knows he's not going to do any damage. Same thing with Tommy Masses has said, and Tommy said this year he was going to concentrate and try to focus and figure out a path to success. There is that drumbeat about incorporating bankroll management somehow into the whole equation. But I suppose if the randomness factor was negated, that those calls might diminish.
Yeah, I love live bankroll play, and we have our own championship in live bankroll play in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. And it's really a very different game. And what's great about the NHC is you can go to the NHC just as a rank-and-file horse player who doesn't even have a dedicated bankroll for gambling, and you can stand toe-to-toe, because it's Mythical Money, with the Tommies and whomever for whom they have that the gambling gene, where they can treat that money like it doesn't even matter. So it's very, very hard to get a blue-collar horse player story in an event like the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, because unless you're treating that money at the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge like Monopoly money, you're bringing a knife to a gunfight. Whereas those players in the NHC Mythical Money format can compete. They're at no disadvantage. And I think there's something very cool about that in the Mythical Money format. What I would like to see, and it wouldn't help players like Andy and Tommy in terms of the first 2 days of the tournament, but I wouldn't hate the idea of potentially having a quote-unquote mythical live bank a la the World Series of Poker and what we did at the World Horse Players Tour. Once you get to the final table, I think that could be interesting. I think it would ratchet up the drama. We did have some drama early at the final table this year. Last year at the final table, we had excellent drama with Scott Coles coming all the way from ninth. But as we saw at the second half of the final table this year, and we've seen it basically all the others, it's not really ready-made for drama. There's a lot of anti-climax the way it's constituted. And there's a few ideas floating around, live bankroll among them, that could make the final table more dynamic. And why that needs to happen to me, Steve, is I feel like this event as currently constituted, it's great. It's gotten far. I don't know how much farther it can get. I think to have a video element, to have a visual element at the final table is the kind of thing that could potentially take this thing to a whole other world. And to do that, I do think the final format needs to be tweaked to just allow for a little more ratcheting up of the drama. And then the other thing about betting money as opposed to mythical money, and this was an idea Keith Shamblin brought up with us again. It was a really good interview we had with him the other day. The idea of making it so this money, even if it's $2 win plays, but maybe finding a way where we could make these bets $10 win plays, could be bet at the windows.
Right.
And folks get to walk away with the money they have. The money gets to be churned through the windows, which just on principle makes me very, very happy. And then also, even if it's a $20 consequence, it does attach a consequence to just picking a number, and might make some of these horse players a little more inclined to bet horses they like throughout. So those are a few thoughts in and around that area of the differences between live bank and mythical contest play like we have at the NHC.
Well, you're also to some degree at the mercy, obviously, of the races and how they, how much potential they have for intrigue. I guess there's not a lot you can do when you get a 10-to-1 shot winning the nightcap, winning the seventh of the seven final table races, and nobody has it. Nobody has it at all, which was shocking. And there were, it's funny, the two biggest prices of the sequence of the final table, the 14-1 Jimmy Ryerson Generazio in that maiden claimer ninth at Aqueduct, and the maiden special winner for Patty Gallagher in Eclipse in the seventh race. So the second and the seventh, they had the best mutuals, and nobody had anything. It was or I think there might have been. Did some? I can't remember. Did somebody have the New York winner?
No, and you had picked the horse right on top in our broadcast, and we were marveling at the fact that no points ended up getting scored there, which was very surprising. And it is unlucky. I mean, some of this lack of drama that I'm lamenting at the final table, it does come down to random luck and the fact that people didn't happen to find those horses. But I don't know. I've seen this enough now to know, with my TV producer hat on, that the first thing I do, if brought in as a consultant by the NTRA to try to remake their final table for video, first thing I do is look in that final table format. I think more drama can be manufactured there.
Well, and you mentioned the winner, and Thomas Goldsmith is... Maybe we should sit down and take the 21 winners at some point, Pete, and you know, do that. What's that four-letter personality test, and figure out the kind of player that we've got each, you know, with each one, because this is another old school player, and you know, somebody that there isn't a lot of. You know, there isn't a lot of bells and whistles going on in his approach. And I'm just looking at his plays. On Friday, he cashed three times in the 18 plays. He had a winner, which was the Gulfstream fourth, 46.60, and two place horses, 14.80 and 7.60. So that was his Friday, you know, just sort of getting a nice foundation. And then on Saturday, he really started to accelerate with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 winners and a placement. And the best winners he had included the Gulfstream 5th. That was one of the mandatories, 47. He had the Tampa 10th. He had that was the Admiralty Pier for 58. And he had River Buoyant as well. So two of the three substantial hits came in the mandatories. Then he also had a $39 win in the Oak Lawn third. So that's what really, you know, accelerated him. He did nice in the electives, and he hit the most attractive opportunities when it came to the mandatories. And then you know, here's the semifinal. He had a $22.60 and a $25 winner. That gets him to the final table when he proceeds to have three winners and the place horse. And actually, the place horse brought him, he had that crazy cap place horse, actually, Gringotts at Aqueduct.
It was a very impressive run, no doubt about it. Some versatility in there. Very comfortable, obviously, at the high end of the odds spectrum. And he talked about his handicapping. The thing that struck me was talking about replays, which is something you do hear from a lot of tournament players. It can be very difficult for trip-oriented players at an event like the NHC because there's just so much work to do. If you're not a professional player tripping these races all the time, and granted, in the weeks before the event, you can get a jump going back and trying to look at some of the races that, you know, maybe with the aid of the condition books, trying to figure out what's going to show up on that day to cut out some of the work. But it's an immense amount of work to do the trips. But if you're good at it, and it just gives you an opportunity to have your own subjective view and maybe to see some things that other people aren't seeing. So the handicapping itself, you can use a pen and paper, but if you've got that ability, that can give you a leg up in trying to find some of these long price winners that propelled Thomas Goldsmith all the way first to the final table and then to its very top, walking with $800,000 and an Eclipse Award for Horse Player of the Year.
Some other things that came up, and I suppose the one, you know, the one thing we didn't ask, we didn't get a chance to ask, and we'll get Goldsmith on for a more detailed discussion. But the one thing we forgot to ask him was, did he take the 135-1 on himself?
No, I totally forgot about that. I didn't hear many stories about the betting. This is for those that don't know, at the sportsbook this year, you could bet on yourself, and unlike the Treasure Island prices, which were incredibly tight, some of these were loose to the point where I would even describe them as good value, and some were just puzzling. I was joking around my friend Eric Bylick, who ends up at the final table and ends up finishing seventh in the pre-betting with one entry. This 28-year-old player was listed as 75-1 when you had players like, for example, NHC Hall of Famer, double qualified Paul Sherman at twice that, 150-1. And at the end of the tournament, we joked that it was yet another case of they knew when it came to the NHC bet, the inexplicable bet down that overperforms there. But it will be curious to see what they do next year if they look for to bring in a consultant for that, or they just end up hanging up numbers. But I would imagine. They did okay. They were taking real bets at this year, as opposed drop the price after $20 of Treasure Island.
I think the first $300 basically didn't move the line, and then anything that came in after 300 started to whittle down lines. And then there was Maven, who ran around to every Caesars property betting on himself.
Fantastic. I talked to him yesterday. I appreciated, you know, he had issue with some of the stuff I was tweeting about the NHC. But he wanted to be constructive and have a back and forth, and I very much appreciated him reaching out privately, because the more sophisticated the conversation, the harder it is to have on Twitter, of course, is one of those rules of life. And I gave him a hard time. I was like, you know, we had our pretty serious conversation for a little while, and I'm like, you know where I'm sitting for 3 days and you don't come say hi? But he just explained that the ballroom atmosphere for him, it's very, you know, for him, he recognizes this as just an amazing opportunity. If there were true prices in this event, I mean, I think he would be a favorite, if not co-favorite, every year. And I think there's a lot of pressure that goes along with knowing what this opportunity represents to him. So he takes it beyond just the headphones. He tried to come up with a way to completely minimize distractions, sitting at a table with people he don't know, finding a wise guy way so he could get out of the ballroom and back up to his room without, you know, walking by people. Not that he's antisocial. It's just, though maybe there's a little of that, but more that it's just trying to protect this opportunity to take the big swing. Wasn't able to put it together this year, but, you know, I'd be shocked if he's not at the final table again in near years. He really does have, I believe, an edge when it comes to a tournament like this. It's just such a match of his skill set between his handicapping ability and his ability to play the game within the game. And so much of tournaments, that's what it's about. And that's not that's a feature to me, not a bug. It's about being able to look and try to determine what the right path is. And he's somebody who really gets it and is, you know, to this point, he's made tremendous contributions in tournaments, but I believe has even more to give in these conversations where it comes to how to maximize tournaments on behalf of not just the horse players, but tournaments themselves. So he's got a lot of good ideas, and you know, I want to continue to keep a door open to him to be a conduit to those as much as he's willing to share.
Well, and you could see the way he was focused. He was very tunnel visioned, walking back and forth whenever I saw him. And I just had the sense that, you know, he didn't want to necessarily be disturbed. But I mean, everybody else that was within eyeshot and seemed to have an interest or an opportunity to talk, they certainly cycled through, and, we had just a really nice mix, as we mentioned, closing out the show. I mean, those of you that heard the last 2 hours, that we used when I was traveling on Monday. We used the and of course the Roxborough visit as well. Those were the portions that we played on Monday. But you know, Rich Eng, and I'll talk to Rich tomorrow. Rich gave us two terrific days, and no Michaels for that hour as we were getting into the final table was great. And then so many of Paul Matisse and Duke, as always, it was great to get Alan Dinkinson on as well and promote his you know, Southern California Horse Rescue and Retraining charity that he supports. And you know, he's a legendary veteran. It's always fun, and every, you know, every 3 days of this ends up being its own unique set piece.
The cast of thousands that came through was particularly impressive this year. One of the things that struck me looking back, Steve, was that we had multiple people at the final table coming to visit us during the final table. We had a couple times we had to just kick them out. Like, get out of here. I think it really ratcheted up the drama. And then I'll just underline how much fun it is to, there's so much good stuff. I'll underline Noel's visit. I really enjoyed that. It's not often that I get to sit down and talk tournaments with somebody who knows more about tournaments than me. That's certainly the case with Noel Michaels, and it was great to get his input. And to me, the number one every year that I want to go back and listen to again is whenever Paul Matisse comes by to visit. It's just fantastic. Wherever the topics go, as I said on Twitter yesterday, I learn something every time the man opens his mouth. So thanks to him also for providing more an invaluable blend of handicapping and color commentary on what's happening in the tournament themselves. Folks should go back and listen in the archive. I'm entertaining this idea, Stephen. You know, it's one of these ideas that time will probably get in the way, but I feel like if somebody could just give me an extra week of my life, I'd love to go through and take the 21 hours and whittle them down to four or three and put all the little best stuff and put a little dramatic through line in. There are plenty of people who will go back and listen to the whole 21 hours.
Oh, my God, yeah.
The truncated version you can get, you wouldn't need to know or care about tournaments to listen through and love, and maybe we could get some people to get the bug.
Well, exactly, and we always do. We hear, I've already heard from three or four people that said how much they either enjoyed, learned, or feel motivated to try to get involved. And you know, Peter Dressens, Pete Dressens, he's the poster boy for getting involved and making it to the semifinals and getting a check, you know, getting paid and out of it. So it's possible for anybody that's listening. And Pete, before we wrap, any adventures, any new discoveries? Because I had a new discovery that I'm going to trumpet left and right. But what was the dining experience?
The first place I'll mention for the beer lovers out there is Abel Baker Brewery. I was super impressed by. I went in and I was nervous because when you see a place that has 12 different styles of beer, it's like I initially get cynical and think, how could you possibly do a good job making this many different styles of beer? Usually places are going to specialize in one or two or three. But Abel Baker did a terrific job. I didn't love everything, but I didn't have a beer there that was bad. And they also had good food and it was just a cool atmosphere. So they'd be on the top of my list. And then dining-wise, we stuck to a lot of classics. Momofuku was great again. Carbone, always, always excellent. But we didn't really hit anything off the beaten path dining-wise. So I'm very eager to hear your recommendations.
Well, in kind of poking around and trying to discover something, which was intentional, and this goes back to when we first discovered Lotus of Siam when it was still in the old
strip mall.
decrepit shopping center that eventually, the city said, you can't stay here any longer. And they built the beautiful new location, but it's become impossible to get into Lotus. It, you know, for years was known by the locals, and then it was discovered by the convention goers and visitors.
Great spot.
it may be the best Thai restaurant in the country. It has that reputation. I found a place called Esther's Kitchen. And not only did I find the restaurant, I found a neighborhood off of Fremont Street, off of downtown. And downtown is resurgent for those that you know went to Fremont Street, you know, in 1968 and haven't been back. It's honky tonk and it's hysterical, but it off of downtown, the whole downtown is getting a real resurgence. There's an arts district. When I asked Dink actually for a push the other day, he actually went museum on us and offered up the pinball museum and the neon museum. The neon museum I knew about from some travel log show, but the pinball museum I didn't know about. Down in this arts district, there's all kinds of fabulous galleries and vintage type stores and antique stores, and it looks terrific. And it was at night, so some things weren't open. But next year we'll get over there to the arts district, and you can also see that there's a lot of residential building that's gone on and condo stuff and so forth. This Esther's Kitchen it was just spectacular. No other description. And I was alone, so I didn't get. I just wanted to zip over there because I wasn't leaving town without trying it. And I tried to get Andy Berg to go on Saturday night, but we ended up at Cafe Martirano, which you know, it just was a matter of convenience. But I'm so glad I went. Rye cavatelli with truffle sausage.
Ooh, sounds lovely.
Unbelievable. And they had you have to order bread, and I didn't realize what was going to happen, but they literally brought half of a loaf that is made in house. And then a little, like a little bowl with a big pat of butter that they churn and olive oil, and then a coarse salt to have with the bread.
Hungry.
It was insane. So I could only eat like two slices of it, and I had to bring home some pasta too because I couldn't finish the pasta. So when the guy came to pack it up, he says, "You want the bread?" I said, "You know what? I do." And he said, "Well," he said, "I would have beaten you up if you'd said no." So I put it into a laundry bag, wrapped it up real tight, and I brought it home to Tina Monday when I got home, and she had defrosted the sausage soup that I left her, and we had it with the sausage soup, and she was blown away how good it was.
So
Esther, it was unbelievable. Esther's Kitchen, and I understand there's a sister restaurant across town as well. I got to get the details. So
new school Italian, or is it more classic, but just with some creative modern flourish?
Creative ingredients and all pasta made in house. They make their own pizza, and based on the bread, they make their own dough for the pizza. So that must be spectacular.
I've got my first reservation for next year.
I'm telling you,
sorted.
Esther's Kitchen, and I'm going to send you. Actually, it's on Facebook. Go see my Facebook check-in and expand the picture. Actually, I'll text it to you. I'll send you the picture of the bar, and you'll go nuts because there was stuff I've never seen before.
Fantastic! You mentioned the Arts District. I tasted one of their beers, and it was good somewhere else, but that's down there too. Tenaya Creek Brewing. It's not in the Arts District, but it's Arts District adjacent. I need to spend time down there next time. Clearly, there is a lot going on. I get a little the strip. I sometimes just feel like I'm hanging out in Times Square. But when I go farther afield, there's some impressive stuff out there, and I'm glad we have you, Steve, to point out all this good stuff.
I'm a bloodhound when it comes to joints and anything offbeat. And Pete, I had so much fun. This was as great a you know, every year it seems to get even better, and I loved Rich Eng, you know, saying that it was like election night coverage without the anguish. Have a great week, and I'm sure there's going to be plenty more fodder and ammunition for conversation.
It's going to be fun. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me in the what's been on Twitter now universally recognized as the Ed McMahon chair. I'll take it.
That's not true.
Any day of the week.
I've had the occasional Carson reference, but I've also had somebody say Tom Snyder, which I have no quibble with.
That's very good.
Well, because I can have a sort of an affectation speech wise, which was a Snyder hallmark.
How about the guy on there who we were talking about my role in this, and he suggested I was the Alan Thicke.
That was a slightly low blow.
But if you're going to be mean to me, make me laugh, and then I forgive you.
Well, there's probably an Arsenio Hall thing to work in here, but I'll leave that to you.
I'm going to leave that alone.
Hey now. Pete Fornatel, everybody, Looms Boldly on Twitter, the In the Money Players podcast with just a variety of great information and entertainment as well. Pete, thanks.
Cheers, my friend. See you next week.
Pete Fornatel. Let's take a break. A little into hour two. Can't wait until you get to hear Sid Fernando and an update, as we foreshadowed last week, on his son, and a really exciting outcome to his aspirations to continue his baseball playing career. Back after this, Sid Fernando, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hillandale.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
At the track or on the go, ExpressBet is your way to play the races. ExpressBet provides legal and secure online and mobile betting on more than 300 of the world's top tracks and all the big events. And when you sign up for an ExpressBet account today with promo code BYK, that's BYK, you'll receive a $125 bonus. Once you've signed up, you can take your wagering experience to the next level with XB Rewards, ExpressBet's industry-leading loyalty program. Earn points for every bet you make and cash them in on everything from wagering credits to exclusive racetrack experiences. So what are you waiting for? Sign up for ExpressBet today using promo code BYK. That's BYK to get your $125 bonus. Conditions apply. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet LLC and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
145 over 92.
180 over 111.
182 over 100. And I had a heart attack and a cardiac arrest. And then a stroke.
Your blood pressure numbers could change your life.
A lot of people don't understand, including myself, I didn't, now I do, the impact of having a stroke.
My memory is shot.
When I woke up, I couldn't speak.
If I would have followed a treatment plan, I would not be in this situation.
It's a tough journey.
Lowering your high blood pressure could save you from a heart attack or stroke. If you've stopped your treatment plan, restart it, or talk to your doctor about creating one that works better for you. Start taking the right steps at manageyourbp.org.
It's a new life, but I'm going to make it better. I'm coming back. Ask your doctor. Check your blood pressure.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.